Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining me today for Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community. My name is Michael Wolin. I'm going to begin this week with some commentary by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks on the Parsha for the week. This week we are starting a new book of the Torah, the book of Numbers. And the Parsha is Bamidbar. Rabbi Sacks titles this, The Sound of Silence. He says, Bamidbar is usually read on the Shabbos, the Sabbath before Shavuot. So the sages connected the two. Shavuot is the time of the giving of the Torah. Bamidbar means in the desert. What then is the connection between the desert and the Torah, the wilderness and God's word? The sages gave several interpretations. According to the Mechilta, the Torah was given publicly, openly, and in a place no one owns, because it had been given in the land of Israel. Jews would have said to the nations of the world, "You have no share in it." Instead, whoever wants to come and accept it, let them come and accept it. Another explanation. Had the Torah been given in Israel, the nations of the world would have had an excuse for not accepting it. This follows the rabbinic tradition that, before God gave the Torah to the Israelites, he offered it to all the other nations, and all of them found a reason to decline it. And yet another. Just as the wilderness is free, it costs nothing to enter, so the Torah is free. It is God's gift to us. But there is another, more spiritual reason. The desert is a place of silence. There is nothing visually to distract you, and there is no ambient noise to muffle sound. To be sure, when the Israelites received the Torah, there was thunder and lightning and the sound of a shofar. The earth felt as if it were shaking at its foundations. But in a later age, when the prophet Elijah stood at the same mountain after his confrontation with the prophets of Baal, he encountered God, not in the whirlwind or the fire or the earthquake, but in the kol demamach daka, the still, small voice, literally, the sound of a slender silence. This is from 1 Kings, chapter 19, verses 9 through 12. I define this as the sound you can only hear if you are listening, in the silence of the midbar, of the desert. You can hear the medaber, the speaker, and the medubar, that which is spoken. To hear the voice of God, you need a listening silence in the soul. Many years ago, British television produced a documentary series, The Long Search, on the world's great religions. When it came to Judaism, the presenter, Ronald Eyer, seemed surprised by its blooming, buzzing confusion, especially the loud, argumentative voices in the Beit Midrash, the house of study. Remarking on this to Elie Wiesel, he asked, "Is there such a thing as silence in Judaism?" And Wiesel replied, "Judaism is full of silences, but we don't talk about them." Judaism is a very verbal culture, a religion of holy words. Through words, God created the universe. Quote, "And God said, let there be, and there was." According to the Targum, it is our ability to speak that makes us human. It translates the phrase, "and man became a living soul," from Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, and "as man became a speaking soul." Words create. Words communicate. Our relationships are shaped, for good or bad, by language. Much of Judaism is about the power of words to make or break worlds. So, silence in Tanakh often has a negative connotation. Aaron was silent, says the Torah, after the death of his two sons, Nadav and Avihu. The dead do not praise you, says Psalm 115, nor do those who go down to the silence of the grave. When Job's friends came to comfort him after the loss of his children and other afflictions, they sat down with him on the ground for 7 days and seven nights, yet no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. But not all silence is sad. Psalms tells us that to you silence is praise. That's from Psalm 65, verse 2. If we are truly in awe at the greatness of God, the vastness of the universe, and the almost infinite extent of time, our deepest emotions will indeed lie too deep for words. We will experience silent communion. The sages valued silence. They called it a fence to wisdom, from the Mishnah Avot, chapter 3, verse 13. If words are worth a coin, silence is worth two, says the Talmud in Megillah 18a. Reb Shimon ben Gamliel said, all my days have grown up among the wise, and I have found nothing better than silence. From Mishnah Avot, chapter 1, verse 17. The service of the priests in the temple was accompanied by silence. The Levites sang in the courtyard, but the priests, unlike their counterparts in other ancient religions, neither sang nor spoke while offering the sacrifices. One scholar, Israel Noel, has accordingly spoken of the silence of the sanctuary. The Zohar speaks of silence as the medium in which both the sanctuary above and the sanctuary below are made. There were also Jews who cultivated silence as a spiritual discipline. Bratislav Hasidim meditate in the fields. There are Jews who practice Ta'anit Dibur, a fast of words. Our most profound prayer, the private saying of the Amidah, is called Tefillah Be'Lachash, the silent prayer. It is based on the precedent of Hannah praying for a child. She spoke in her heart, her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. From the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 1, verse 13. God hears our silent cry. In the agonizing tale of how Sarah told Abraham to send Hagar and her son away, the Torah tells us that when their water ran out and the young Ishmael was at the point of dying, Hagar cried, yet God heard the voice of the child. Earlier, when the angels came to visit Abraham and told him that Sarah would have a child, Sarah laughed inwardly, that is, silently, yet she was heard by God. God hears our thoughts, even when they are not expressed in speech. The silence that counts in Judaism is thus a listening silence, and listening is the supreme religious art. Listening means making space for others to speak and be heard. As I point out in my commentary to the Siddur, there is no English word that remotely equals the Hebrew word Shema in its wide range of senses, to listen, to hear, to pay attention, to understand, to internalize, and to respond indeed. This was one of the key elements in the Sinai covenant, when the Israelites, having already said twice, all that God says we will do, then said, all that God says we will do, and we will hear, the Hebrew ve-nishma. It is the nishma, the listening, the hearing, the heeding, the responding, that is the key religious act. Thus, Judaism is not only a religion of doing and speaking, it is also a religion of listening. Faith is the ability to hear the music beneath the noise. There is the silent music of the spheres, about which Psalm 19 speaks. Quote, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day to day they pour forth speech. Night to night they communicate knowledge. There is no speech, there are no words. Their voice is not heard, yet their music carries throughout the earth." That's Psalm 19. "There is the voice of history that was heard by the prophets, and there is the commanding voice of Sinai that continues to speak to us across the abyss of time. I sometimes think that people in the modern age have found the concept of Torah from heaven to be problematic, not because of some new archaeological discovery, but because we have lost the habit of listening to the sound of transcendence, a voice beyond the merely human." It is fascinating that despite the often fractured relationship with Judaism, Sigmund Freud created in psychoanalysis a deeply Jewish form of healing. He himself called it the speaking cure, but it is in fact a listening cure. Almost all effective forms of psychotherapy involve deep listening. Is there enough listening in the Jewish world today? Do we, in marriage, really listen to our spouses? Do we, as parents, truly listen to our children? Do we, as leaders, hear the unspoken fears of those we seek to lead? Do we internalize the sense of hurt of the people who feel excluded from the community? Can we really claim to be listening to the voice of God if we fail to listen to the voices of our fellow humans? In his poem, In Memory of W.B. Yeats, W.H. Auden wrote, "In the deserts of the heart, let the healing fountain start." From time to time, we need to step back from the noise, the hubbub of the social world, and create in our hearts the stillness of the desert, where, within the silence, we can hear the Kol Demamach Daka, the still, small voice of God, telling us we are loved, we are heard, we are embraced by God's everlasting arms. We are not alone. Well, there you have commentary by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks, titled The Sound of Silence, Commentary on Parsha Bamidbar. Well, here's a little bit of history for you. This is an article about a gentleman, a spy. And this article I got from the organization Harut. The title is simply The Spy Who Changed the Face of the Middle East. When people think about the hero of Israel's incredible victory in the Six-Day War, Moshe Dayan comes to mind for most people. In the opinion of some, the real hero of Israel's surprise victory is a spy, Eli Cohen. Even though he was executed by Syria 2 years before the Six-Day War, more than any one single person, Eli Cohen was the hero of the June 1967 conflict. On May 18, 1965, Eli Cohen, the Israeli intelligence asset who penetrated the highest levels of Syria's political and military elite before being arrested and convicted of espionage, was executed at Damascus's Martyrs Square. Israeli spy Eli Cohen was publicly executed by the Syrians. This execution was aired on Syrian national television. After his execution, a sign with anti-Zionist messages was placed on his hanging body, and his body was left to hang for 6 hours. Cohen's body still has not been returned to his family. Even though it was 2 years before the Six-Day War, more than any one single person, L.A. Cohen was the hero of the June 1967 conflict. Cohen was recruited into Israeli military intelligence in 1960. He was given a false identity as a Syrian Arab returning to Syria after living in Argentina. To establish his cover, Cohen moved to Argentina in 1961. Early the following year, Cohen moved to Damascus. He had the foresight to embed himself with the Ba'ath Party, which he believed would soon rule Syria. They took over the country via a military coup in 1963. By that time, Eli Cohen, known in Syria as Kamel Amin Saabe, was entrenched within the social elites of Syria. He became a trusted friend of the highest-ranking members of the party, while at the same time using the hidden transmitter in his home to send Israel Syria's secrets. Because of his high position in Syria's social strata, in 1963 he was invited to discussions regarding Syria's intentions to divert water from the headwaters of the Jordan River. That would have cut off an essential Israeli fresh water source. Cohen transmitted the diversion plan back to Israel, and the Israeli Air Force effectively destroyed the Syrian plan. Note, for those of you who have never been to Israel, it is called the Jordan River, but it's more like a creek. Cohen's most historic and significant achievement was setting up the Golan Heights to be conquered by Israel in the Six-Day War. The Golan Heights is a plateau that overlooks the Syrian-Israel border. It allowed the Syrian military, who had the high ground, to send armaments into northern Israeli villages, and not armaments in the sense of weapons per se, but rather the ammunition from them. They used the Golan Heights to bombard Israeli villages and snipers to just simply shoot at people that they saw. Usually, non-military personnel were not allowed to visit the Syrian Golan Heights fortifications. This was a top-secret area that only senior members of the Syrian military were allowed to visit. However, Eli Cohen got a tour of the Golan Heights and a comprehensive military briefing of the strategic area and all its positions. His most significant action was set up during this visit. Cohen put the equivalent of a target on the Syrian bunkers in the Golan Heights. He suggested to the Syrian military that eucalyptus trees should be planted around the military bunkers and mortars which were targeting Israel. Cohen convinced his Syrian friends that the trees would provide natural cover for the outposts, since eucalyptus trees grow very quickly, preventing soldiers and personnel from suffering the effects of heat stroke. They thought it was a great idea, and they planted the trees. The Syrians did not realize it was an even more significant idea for the Israeli Air Force. Cohen passed on the information to Israeli intelligence. During the Six-Day War, most of those Golan Heights locations were destroyed by targeting the eucalyptus trees. The mature trees are still evident today when visiting the sites. There is no information about how many people whose lives were saved by the information that Cohen broadcast. In January of 1965, hired Soviet experts caught Eli Cohen sending a radio message after large amounts of radio interference brought attention. At the time, Eli Cohen was the third in line for the presidency of Syria. In fact, the Israeli spy had been suggested as a future Syrian president. After a showcase trial, he was found guilty of espionage. He was publicly hanged by the very embarrassed Syria, May 18, 1965. And to this day, Syria still refuses to return Eli Cohen's remains to his family for burial in Israel. The Jerusalem Post interviewed the radio operator who received and decoded Cohen's messages while he was in Syria. He said, I didn't know who was sending the messages. It was, however, clear that the short messages were of extreme importance, which later helped determine Israel's destiny ahead of the Six-Day War. After Eli Cohen was captured, the Syrian military transmitted the last original message to military intelligence headquarters in Israel. The message was to Prime Minister Levi Eshkol and the handler of his spies. Kamel, that is Eli Cohen's fake identity name in Syria, and his friends have been staying by us for some 3 years. Signed, Syrian Arab Intelligence. A, who throughout his intelligence career transmitted, received, and decoded tens of thousands of messages from Israeli spies, said he remembered receiving the final transmission. Now, the A refers to that person, that was his code name, A. There was great excitement and sadness, he said. We ran to our commander with the message, and he passed it on to Eli Cohen's handlers, and we understood that it was over. 58 years have passed since Eli Cohen was executed, but he is still considered by the defense establishment as the greatest spy in Israeli history. Cohen operated behind enemy lines, establishing close ties with top Syrian political and military leadership from 1962 until he was hanged. Cohen's transmissions were instrumental in helping the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, prepare for the 1967 war with Syria. He provided information about the Syrian Air Force and military positions on the Golan. Mossad Chief Meir Amit said, Eli succeeded far beyond the capabilities of most other men. According to A, Cohen used to send daily messages, always at the same time of the day, 8:30 in the morning. Cohen, known by his handlers, you'd say, as by the number 566, wrote in encrypted French and sent his messages via a tiny radio transmitter. With that message, Israel's leaders knew what Eli Cohen would face. Cohen was tortured and convicted by a military tribunal that had denied him a lawyer. Despite many appeals, including from Pope Paul VI and the governments of France, Belgium, and Canada, the Syrian government refused to commute the death sentence. Eli Cohen was executed in Martyr Square in Damascus in May 1965 before some 10,000 spectators and a national TV audience. Although the Six-Day War wouldn't happen for another 2 years, Eli Cohen was one of the keys to Israel's victory over Syria in 1967. There is no question that the intelligence that he sent was instrumental in allowing Israel to quickly and effectively defeat the Syrians and regain the Golan Heights. All they had to do was target the trees. His actions were a big part of Israel's overwhelming victory in the Six-Day War and in capturing the Golan Heights. Syria could no longer use the high ground of the Golan as a staging ground to send rockets into northern Israel. He saved a major part of Israel's already short supply drinking water, and his transmission saved many people's lives. He changed the face of the Middle East. And after that war, the Israeli military was feared. Eli Cohen was a true hero. May his memory always be for a blessing. Had Root North America, the organization where I found this article, learned from Cohen's actions? Eli Cohen gave his life to protect the inalienable rights of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. The Herut mission statement directs the organization to promote the inalienable rights of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. Herut is an international movement for Jewish unity, Zionist pride, protecting the Jewish people worldwide, and Zionist education. Herut operates per the ideals of pre-World War II Zionist leader and philosopher Ze'ev Jabotinsky. We'll hear more about him today, if we have time. I think we will. Well, there you have it. Eli Cohen, Israel's greatest spy, and how he facilitated the victory in 1967 war, changed the face of the Middle East. Well, who is it that wants to destroy Israel? You might be surprised. On April 17 and 18, Israel observed Holocaust Martyrs and Heroes Remembrance Day. Sirens sounded across the country while people stood for 2 minutes of silence in remembrance of 6 million Jews who had been murdered. Wreaths were laid at the Yad Vashem World Holocaust Remembrance Center. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu delivered a speech calling on Israelis for unity. The speech, however, apparently was not heard by everyone. Protests against his government soon resumed. A week later, April 24 and 25th, on Memorial Day, when Israelis pay their respects to soldiers who have fallen so that Israel might live, Netanyahu once again called for unity. The next day, when Israel celebrated Independence Day, some people decided not to participate in the official ceremony and instead held a protest celebration. Following the November 2022 elections, Israel has been plunged into turmoil. Massive demonstrations, both in support of and against the government, have been organized for weeks. Ostensibly, the demonstrations are concerning a proposed judicial reform bill, but in reality appear to be about retaining or overthrowing the newly elected government. Some demonstrators want to overthrow the government and permanently eliminate Netanyahu from Israeli politics. Others, even more, believe he is the best prime minister to lead them through a time when the entire Middle East, including Israel, is facing the threat of nuclear destruction from a relentless Iran. It is the first time in Israel's short history that a large-scale movement has been launched using undemocratic means to overthrow a democratically elected government. Just as an aside here, it sounds as if maybe the Israeli left has taken a page from the American left in their relentless, undemocratic, illegal opposition to President Trump. It's also the first time that Israeli opposition political leaders, including former military chiefs of staff, have issued calls for civil disobedience and incited IDF reservists to not appear for duty. In a country under constant threat, such a move is considered, or was considered, inconceivable. Former Prime Minister Ehud Barak, in the UK on March 27, outlined with no visible shame his strategy to topple Israel's government, which he incorrectly defined as basically a dictatorship. For a citizen of a democratic country to go to a foreign country to say he wants to topple his own government could be considered an act of treason. Barak did not even try to hide that those who follow him are a tiny minority, 3.5% of a population, he stated, is enough to overthrow a government. Yair Lapid, former interim prime minister until December of last year, 2022, was in New York in April to meet the leaders of American Jewish organizations. He also urged the overthrow of Israel's democratically elected government. "You have a voice," he encouraged leaders of American Jewish organizations, "and you have the right to use it." The leaders of a nonprofit organization, Am Echad, committed to strengthening the connection between Israel and Jews outside of Israel, replied, quote, "It is disingenuous of you to accuse the government of undermining Israeli democracy and calling on American Jews to get up in arms to protect Israel from its own leadership," end quote. Other Israeli politicians and former military chiefs joined in. Moshe Ya'alon, a former defense minister and former IDF chief of general staff, accused Netanyahu of sacrificing democracy and of being, quote, "ready to burn down the country and its values." Former IDF chief of general staff Gadi Eisenkot claimed that Netanyahu and his government are badly harming the national interests of the state of Israel, and so on. By contrast, Morton Klein, head of the Zionist Organization of America, said that Lapid's traitorous trip is a disgrace that has cemented his status as head of the disloyal opposition. Klein accused Lapid of sowing anarchy and fomenting outside foreign pressures that trample upon the will of the Israeli public. Palestinian terrorist organizations, meanwhile, took advantage of the disruption to kill more Jews. The year 2022 had been one of the deadliest years in recent memory in Israel, which is the reason a strong government led by Netanyahu was elected in the first place. For Israel's enemies, the damage done to Israel's international reputation is always near the top of their wish list. The international media, always ready to show its contempt for Israel, also seems to enjoy what is happening. Articles in the European press blindly describe, incorrectly, the Netanyahu government as an extreme right-wing government with fascist tendencies. On March 30, journalist Joshua Leifer wrote in Britain's The Guardian paper that Israel hasn't been a democracy for a long time. Now Israelis need to face this fact. In France's Le Monde, Netanyahu, along with the cabinet ministers Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, are described as racists and Jewish supremacists. Israeli democracy faces a mortal threat. Israeli novelist David Grossman wrote in The Atlantic, "The threat he speaks of is the Netanyahu government, which he too incorrectly describes as wanting to abolish democracy." The new government, in fact, is trying to restore democracy by reforming Supreme Court practices that were adopted starting in the 1990s, which allow unelected, unaccountable Supreme Court justices to deliver rulings based on reasonableness rather than on written law. And that often means whatever I think is reasonable. Israel's Supreme Court is currently said to have virtually limitless power. It asserts the right to veto both political appointments and military decisions. It has no mechanism for recourse and no requirement for standing, meaning that the litigant need not be directly affected by the decision, such as having a personal wrong righted. On the contrary, anyone can directly petition the Supreme Court anytime about anything. The last provision has opened the floodgates for lawsuits by concerned non-governmental organizations dissatisfied with decisions Israel has taken. In addition, sitting Supreme Court justices, not the electorate, not the parliament, have the power to approve or veto any appointment of new justices, leading to a closed club in which no one is flustered by dissent. Because there is no dissent. Israel's Supreme Court currently has almost limitless power. There is no mechanism for recourse. As far as economic damage goes, 255 American Jewish business leaders on March 13 published an open letter saying that they, quote, feel compelled to reevaluate their reliance on Israel as a strategic destination for investment. On March 8, an Israeli technology company, Riskified, announced that it had decided to transfer $500 million out of the country and offered relocation packages to staff members. On April 16, Moody's credit rating agency downgraded the credit outlook of the Israeli economy from positive to stable. The move was seen by many as just the continuation of ongoing efforts to overthrow Israel's government by economic warfare. U.S. President Joe Biden on March 28 harshly criticized the Israeli government. "I'm very concerned," he said. "They," meaning the members of the Israeli government, "cannot continue down this road. And I've sort of made that clear." He added he will not invite Netanyahu to the White House in the near term. "Israel," Netanyahu answered, "is a sovereign country which makes its decisions by the will of its people, not based on pressures from abroad, including from the best of friends." The Biden administration, staffed by many of the same people who were in the Obama administration, has behaved as an enemy of Israel from day one. The administration quickly restored U.S. funding to the Palestinian Authority without asking it to stop supporting terrorism or even to stop inciting violence. The Biden administration then opened a U.S. Office for Palestinian Affairs and installed, as a special representative for Palestinian affairs, Hadi Amr, who has admitted to being inspired by the Palestinian Intifada. The 2022 Country Report on Human Rights Practices, published by the U.S. Department of State, describes Israel as a country that does not respect the most essential human rights. Those who wrote the report based their accusations on leftist and pro-Palestinian NGOs that are cited extensively throughout the text. The report alleges, without any reference to the threats of extermination from and terrorism perpetrated by the Palestinian Authority, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, and behind them all, an openly genocidal Iran, that the Israeli government or its agents commit arbitrary or unlawful killings, use torture, and practice arbitrary arrest and detention, none of which is true. Since the day Netanyahu won the Israeli elections in November of last year, the Biden administration's hostility towards Israel has grown, and it seems now to be directly trying to bring down the Netanyahu government while supporting Netanyahu's enemies, both inside and outside of Israel. The administration uses U.S. taxpayer money to fund the Movement for Quality Government, an Israeli NGO that organizes protests and disseminates propaganda hostile to Netanyahu and his government. The Biden administration has, however, to its credit, during the hundreds of recent missile attacks, 1,235 rockets over 5 days launched at a country the size of New Jersey, said that Israel has the right to protect itself and defend its people from indiscriminate rocket attacks launched by terrorist groups, yet for the past 2 years has done nothing to eliminate Israel's most serious threat, Iran's nuclear program. apart from seemingly trying to have Iran not use any nuclear weapons during the current administration's term. The Biden administration has, additionally, considerably eroded America's influence in the Middle East, thereby creating a situation of extreme peril for Israel and other erstwhile U.S. allies in the Gulf. Biden, even during his 2020 presidential campaign, repeatedly vowed to treat Saudi Arabia as a pariah. Just weeks after his inauguration, the Biden administration removed from the U.S. list of foreign terrorist organizations the Houthis, one of Iran's proxy militias that had been waging a civil war in Yemen for years, on the way to the real target, Saudi Arabia. Two Houthis reacted to this courtesy by ratcheting up attacks on Saudi Arabia and on Abu Dhabi, while the Biden administration refused to put the Houthis back on the terror list. This rebuff was followed by the Biden administration's refusal to promise either that it would stop negotiating with Iran for a deal enabling the mullahs to have unlimited nuclear weapons, and fears that the U.S. would not protect Saudi Arabia and other Arab allies in the Gulf from Iran. The seemingly unremitting desire of the Biden administration to reach an agreement with Iran at almost any price and to realign American foreign policy in the Middle East towards a policy led by Iran was evidently what led to Saudi Arabia's restoration of ties with Iran. They're hedging their bets. Biden's eagerness to treat Saudi Arabia as a pariah had turned an ally into a question mark. Meanwhile, the Iranian regime, more expansionist by the day, which the Saudi regime is not, reveals that despite the decidedly unsavory murder of Osama bin Laden's friend and Muslim Brotherhood acolyte Jamal Khashoggi, the Iranian regime is, by light years, far more dangerous to the stability of the region and beyond, as well as even more hostile to human rights than Saudi Arabia ever was. As many of the U.S. sanctions on Iran have been lifted, it's grown even more aggressive. Accelerating its quest for nuclear weapons, Iran can now enrich uranium to 84% purity and raise it quickly to weapons grade. Moreover, the Strategic Cooperation Agreement signed in March of 2021 between Iran and China has deepened the ties between the mullahs and the Chinese Communist Party, geopolitically and economically, to the detriment of the United States. The means of payment on which they agreed will not be the world's reserve currency for oil, the U.S. dollar, but instead it will be China's currency, the yuan. Iran's mullahs also can see that the United Arab Emirates in 2021 signed a contract with the Chinese company Huawei, now building a 5G network in the Gulf state, thereby making the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, totally vulnerable to Chinese intelligence penetration. That contract was followed by the cancellation of a $23 billion arms purchase from the United States. The mullahs also saw that the UAE Foreign Minister Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan welcomed a deal between Saudi Arabia and them and called it an important step for the region towards stability and prosperity. As for Israel, Iran's mullahs can see that their access to nuclear weapons is considered by Netanyahu and his government a mortal danger to Israel, and that the current turmoil in Israel might, they hope, make Israeli action against them, against Iran, more difficult. The official Iranian media headline statements by former Israeli Prime Ministers Barak and Lapid claiming Israel was on the verge of collapse. It's quite possible that Iran's plan to wipe Israel off the map will never be implemented, but the mullah's dream of doing so have existed since the first days of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Hezbollah and Hamas have many thousands of missiles, some of them precision-guided, and Iran has transferred a very large number of missiles and UAVs to Syria, that's drones, that are ready to be launched. Iran, Hezbollah, and Hamas most likely hope that a rain of missiles far more intense than that launched by Hamas in May of 2021 against Israel could exhaust the stock of Iron Dome air defense interceptors. The mullahs apparently hope that such an attack would have catastrophic consequences. If an attack were launched against Israel, China, Russia, and European countries would most likely protest verbally, but would not act to defend Israel. The mullahs probably assume that the Biden administration, already involved in Ukraine and anticipating trouble from the Chinese Communist Party in the Indo-Pacific, such as trying to take over Taiwan, would, like Europe, fail to react. Biden, hoping to win the 2024 election, will most likely tell the cameras that Israel has the right to defend itself, but he would avoid intervening at all costs. Recently, the U.S. removed munitions stored in Israel and shipped them to Ukraine. The material has not been replaced. A few weeks ago, when a key official in Israel's defense ministry was in Washington to request more American support for Israel in case the Israeli government thinks necessary to attack Iran's nuclear program, no answer was given. Hezbollah, Hamas, and their Iranian bosses believe they can attack Israel with impunity, wrote Israeli journalist Caroline Glick last month. Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah and Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps commander Hossein Salami, along with various Hamas and Islamic Jihad commanders and preachers, have given speeches declaring Israel is falling apart and its destruction is imminent, and calling for their jihadist forces to prepare for victory. In a later column, Glick wrote, "With our ruling class in full revolt, Israel's most important institutions, first and foremost the IDF, are reeling. Our ability to defend ourselves on the battlefield and in diplomatic circles is constrained as never before. With our elites declaring our government illegitimate and lobbying American Jews and politicians to boycott our leaders and reject the morality of the public that voted them into office, the government must fight against our enemies, against anti-Semitism, against BDS campaigns, and against anti-Israel propaganda machines, with both hands tied behind its back, its mouth gagged while hopping on one foot. This situation is unsustainable. We must find a way to restore sanity and a sense of common destiny to our national life. We don't have a spare country. Our ruling class needs to return to its senses and remember this obvious fact." On April 27, hundreds of thousands of Israelis poured into Jerusalem for a rally to support the government. One protester said, "Who wants to destroy Israel? Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah, and of course, the Israeli left today is also a danger to the country." "Look how much strength we have," Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich said to the crowd. "They have the media and tycoons who finance demonstrations. We have the majority of the people who demand and give us full backing to fix what needs to be fixed. We will not give up." The land of Israel and the state of Israel are acquired through many trials and tribulations, Netanyahu announced on April 24. "They will not overcome us. We will overcome them." A terrorist carried out a car ramming attack at Jerusalem's Mahane Yehuda market a few hours earlier. Netanyahu was talking about terrorists, but his words could be addressed to all enemies of Israel and to all those who want to destroy it. Well, this article was written by Dr. Guy Millieri, a professor at the University of Paris and the author of 27 books on France and Europe, and a prolific writer about things to do with Israel. And just to remind you, the title of this article was, Who Wants to Destroy Israel? You might be surprised. Indeed. Well, I think we have time for one more. Here's a short article on Why Kiss the Mezuzah? And this was posed originally as a question for the rabbi, who answers, The mezuzah, which is placed on doorways in Jewish homes, holds a piece of parchment containing two selections of verses from Deuteronomy. One is the Shema prayer, which expresses the unity of God. The verses start with, Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. And it continues with a commandment to love God with all your heart. And this parchment is put in a small case and fastened to the doorposts of the home. The tradition in many Jewish homes is to place one's hand on the mezuzah when passing by, and there are those who kiss the hand that touched it. What's the source of the custom? Well, here we go. The first record of someone touching a mezuzah this way is found in the Talmud in a story of the famous Roman convert to Judaism, Onkelos, the son of Callonymus. The Talmud relates that the Roman emperor sent soldiers to bring Onkelos to him. They went, and Onkelos told them verses from the Torah, and they were inspired and converted. The emperor sent another group, telling them not to tell him anything. Onkelos said, Let me tell you something trivial. Inspired by his words, they all converted. And the emperor sent yet another group of soldiers and told them not to discuss anything with him. And as they were taking him out of the house, Onkelos saw a mezuzah on the doorway. He stretched out his arm and touched it. Onkelos asked them, What is this that I am touching? And the soldiers responded, You tell us. He then explained to them, It is the custom of the world that the king sits in the inside of the palace, and the guards protect him from the outside. However, with God, his servants are inside their homes, and he protects them from the outside. As the verse says in Psalms, God will protect your departure and your arrival from now and forever. The soldiers were inspired, and they converted. The emperor did not send any more soldiers. Based on this passage, Rabbi Moses Isserles added in a gloss in the Code of Jewish Law. Some have the custom to place their hand on the mezuzah when they leave their home and say, God will protect your departure, and the same when one enters the home. One should place the hand on the mezuzah. Why place the hand on the mezuzah? Commentaries explain it reminds you to contemplate the unity of God. As Maimonides expressed in his writing, the Mishneh Torah, a person needs to be very careful in their observance of the mezuzah, for it is incumbent on every individual and during the entire day. Through the mezuzah, every time a person enters or leaves their home, they will encounter the unity of God and remember their love of God. Thus, they will awaken from his sleep and recognize their obsession with the vanity of the times, and he will know that there is nothing that lasts eternally beside the knowledge of the Creator of the world. Through contemplating this, the person will regain awareness and follow the path of the upright. Well, one more comment about this. The Rebbe, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson of Righteous Memory, in one of his talks, praised the custom of children kissing a mezuzah prior to going to bed. The Rebbe explained how what a person sees and hears as a child influences them as an adult, and that for children, kissing a mezuzah engraves in them recognition that there is one God that watches over them and all that is found in their room. Well, if you ever wondered, why do people do that? Why do they affix a mezuzah to their doorpost? What's in it? And what does it mean when they touch it and then kiss their hand? There we go. And I mentioned earlier that I had some other words to say about Jabotinsky. Here's a quote of his. He says, "We are a people, as all other peoples. We do not have any intentions to be better than the rest. We do not have to account to anybody. We are not to sit for anybody's examination, and nobody is old enough to call on us to answer. We came before them. We will leave after them. We are what we are. We are good for ourselves. We will not change, nor do we want to." A quote to keep in mind for those that are lovers of Zion by Jabotinsky. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I see that we are about out of time. So in closing, I want to thank you for joining me for Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community. I hope you found them insightful or educational, entertaining perhaps, in some way valuable. I want to remind you that my name is Michael Wolin, and I also want to wish all of you a good Shabbos, Shabbat Shalom, and Shavua Tov. Have a good week.